From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley.
And near Princeton, I'm Cornell West, and this is Smiley and West.
See what happens when you go to Puerto Rico, Doc? The entire government shuts down. It's good to have you back, although your return has not brought the government back yet. What's the problem?
No, I tell you, we got that spirit of Bezos Campos and Lolita LeBron. I was there with Brother Samuel Cruz. We had a magnificent time, almost 2,000 people there in the theater and 500 in the seminary, and it was a beautiful thing, but we're focusing on the pardon for Oscar Lopez Rivera. Let him out, Mr. President.
I know they appreciate your work and your presence and your witness, and it's good to have you back. After a week of Nobel Prize announcements, we've got our own Nobel Peace Prize winner today, Mairead McGuire. She'll be joining us from Belfast, where she's been fighting for peace and justice since the 1970s. And we'll get her take, Doc, today on her feelings about sharing that Peace Prize with one Barack Obama.
Indeed. Plus, one of our listeners wants to take us to task for our stance on the minimum wage.
How could you be opposed to raising the minimum wage to a living wage? Anyway, we'll hear what they have to say. That's all just ahead. But first, as always, we start with the hot stuff. With all your traveling and teaching, Doc, as I said a moment ago, this is the first time we've had a chance to talk about the government shutdown on this program. As always, there is a chance that as we speak, as we record this conversation, events in Washington might trump us and the government might come back full force from my mouth to God's ears. But that said, what is your take, as you put it, of this sad spectacle that happened in the first place?
Yeah, I'm telling you, though, brother, I mean, this the dysfunctionality of the government with the reactionaries on the right, who are blackmailing the president. You've got the neoliberals in the Senate, the president and the Democrats, who even if they push through, it still doesn't begin to speak to the needs of poor people and working people. And then, of course, you've got the oligarchs and the plutocrats sitting in back thinking, well, how does this affect me? How does this affect stock market? How does this affect Wall Street and working people and poor people? Their suffering rendered invisible in terms of it being addressed in any meaningful way. It's a very sad affair, though, brother.
I think you and I both agree that this crisis could have been averted in the first place if John Boehner had not given in, if he had not punted or been punked, as it were, by a handful of Republicans in the House. What do you make of his desire to hold on to leadership so much that he put the country at stake?
Well, he's just so deeply influenced by the reactionaries, about the 80 reactionaries in the Republican Party, and he wants to preserve his position. But we have to keep in mind that it's a catastrophe before the shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Catastrophe for poor and working people before the shutdown. The shutdown just reinforces even more the catastrophe for poor and working people. So in that sense, what we're really seeing is the degree to which our government has become so thoroughly dysfunctional that it can't even reproduce the conditions for Wall Street to thrive, for the well-to-do to strive. And of course, for our media, for the most part, it's only a crisis when it affects the well-to-do and the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a crisis when it affects the poor and working people, because poor and working people hardly make an appearance of any real substance on most of corporate media.
Mm-hmm. See, part of the problem here is, and again, I think you and I will probably agree on this, is that these Republicans, this handful of Republicans who backed John Boehner into this corner, and again, because he was more concerned about his leadership than the state of the country, he gave in to them. It makes a statement about the fact that, you know, a few people can really hijack the entire government. What do you make mm-hmm. of the politics and the process of that?
Well, we already saw that the vast majority of Americans wanted single-payer health care.
That's right.
But that will was thwarted by the lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people who want peace in the Middle East is thwarted by lobbyists. Vast majority of American people want the shutdown to come to a close. It's thwarted by elites tied to big money, big corporations, and narrow vision. So that what we're really seeing is the relative death of the democratic process. And my God, once the courts kick in the next few weeks and allow even for Citizens United to become a stepping stone for more oligarchic and plutocratic control. And then you link that to the National Security Agency keeping track of all of our phone calls. Brother, this is on the road to a soft American fascism, man. It's a police state in the making, and it's a very, very sad thing to behold.
that phrase, I suspect, will ring in people's ears. You said a soft American fascism?
A soft American fascism. And it's not soft for those below. You know, you got, for Brother Herman Wallace, who was in solitary confinement for 41 years in a 6-foot by 9-foot prison cell, it wasn't a soft American fascism at all. For poor people, it's not a soft American fascism. It's the police state keeping track. People under surveillance, stop and frisk policies across the board, tied to the new Jim Crow, tied to the prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
But soft really means that it doesn't affect enough middle class persons so that they can't see clearly just how dominating and oppressive the system is.
Mm. I want to come back to Herman Wallace here in a moment here. Before we do that, though, you know, one of the things that's been fascinating for me where these Republicans are concerned, and we certainly have had our critique of the president and might still, if he starts to give in on some of these outrageous demands.
Which is possible any minute.
Absolutely.
Jesus, keep us near the cross.
Anything is possible.
Anything, I'm telling you.
Yeah, lines drawn in the sand can be easily erased, so we will see what happens in the coming days. But one of the things that I find fascinating about this is that these are the same people, these Republicans, who constantly beat the rest of us over the head with this notion of respect for the rule of law. Respect for the rule of law. That's one of their talking points in any appearance they make on any subject matter, even if it's not relevant. They're going to bring in the notion of respect for the rule of law. How do you even threaten to shut the government down, much less follow through on it, because you want to defund a health care program, watered down though it might have been? You want to defund something that is law, that has been upheld by the Supreme Court, but you want to lecture people all the time about respect for the rule of law. Is that the ultimate irony or what?
No, you absolutely. In fact, I would even go further, Brother Tavis. Sean Wilens put it well in the Times last
week. I saw that piece, yeah.
You saw that?
Yeah.
It's a violation of the Constitution of that section of the 14th Amendment that talks about the validity of the debt, which must always be grounded in the actions of Congress and the White House. I have a reactionaries in the Republican Party who are violating the Constitution and undercutting rule of law, yet they're the ones who always talked about the Constitution being quasi-sacred and the rule of law being quasi-sacred. The level of mendacity and hypocrisy is just so overwhelming that you know, you got to listen to a little Hank Williams and B.B. King to preserve your sanity.
Mm-hmm. To your point now, and I don't think this is hyperbolic at all, but this is what you have warned about for years, is what I've talked about in my work, is what we talked about together in The Rich and the Rest of Us, that poverty and these related kinds of political spectacles are really threatening our very democracy. Now, when you raise that issue, oftentimes you get accused of being anti-American, but I wonder to what extent you think, you know, we are really wrestling with, that we're ready to wrestle with, I should say, ready to come to terms with how dangerously close to the edge we are, given the way our society is breaking down, the devolution of our culture, the decay of the civilization. What do you make of whether or not we're ready to wrestle with how close we are to the edge? That's what I'm getting at here.
Well, I think when you look at the American empire through the lens of poor and working people, it has often been the case that it seemed as if America lacked the spiritual, political, and economic capacity to treat its poor and working people with decency and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not new. But what we see now is in its naked form, what we see now in its raw and coarse form, the not just the contradictions, but the hypocrisy that becomes undeniable. And the fundamental challenge becomes, well, what then do poor and working people do? How do we organize? How do we mobilize? How do we tell the truth? How do we gain the courage? How do we gain the vision and begin to see that either we begin to move in a more radically democratic way or we lose a democracy?
Yeah, it is that serious. I just wonder whether or not we see it as such, or whether or not there are just a couple of us who actually see it that way.
I think more and more are waking up, though, brother. And it's not a question of skin color. It's not a question of personality. It's a question of integrity. It's a question of principle.
Yeah. You know, I want to add one other thing right quick that just occurs to me as we talk about this shutdown. We'll move on to Herman Wallace here because I do want to get to that. It is interesting to me that even when, you talk about irony, even when President Obama finds his spine to stand up to the Republicans, the people who are being trampled the most still happen to be black people. This government shutdown is hurting black people disproportionately more than any other segment of our society. So even when he does, in fact, stiffened his spine, it is still the case that even in that moment, black people are catching the most hell.
And many black people don't want to talk about it, even given the suffering, because of their connection to the president on a symbolic level. And that's a very sad blinding that needs to be lovingly called into question, because it's a matter of principle, it's a matter of integrity, and it's a matter of love, really. And if you really love poor folk and you love black folk, then you make them a priority in how you view the world.
That's right. That's right. Speaking of lovingly challenging people, I wonder whether or not this story just it broke my heart that Herman Wallace, after 41 years in a 6x9 solitary confinement cell. Can you imagine 41 years of confinement, solitary confinement in a 6x9 cell? I literally, in my house the other day, pulled out my tape measure, Doc, and on the floor, I wanted to mark 6x9. I marked 6x9 on the floor of my living room, and I put myself inside that 6x9. I really wanted to just, for my own self, illustrate so that I could see and feel what it was like to be confined. And I'm 6 feet tall as it is. I'm 6'1". So the cell he's in is 6x9. And that's where he stayed for 41 years. When he's on his deathbed, he finally gets released. So he dies a free man in the sense that he's not behind those bars. When he dies, the federal judge let him go. But I wonder whether or not you think that this case, which did get some attention last week, we always want more, but I was actually pleased with the fact that the story did get out in some mainstream media outlets. I wonder, though, whether or not you think that this case will shine any kind of spotlight on the deadly injustice of our prison system.
And it's a form of torture. So don't anybody tell us that torture does not exist. America stands against torture. No. Solitary confinement is a kind of torture. It was viewed as unconstitutional by the governor of Louisiana days before Brother Herman died, but it's too late. You know, it's just morally revolting, and the idea that our criminal justice system is fair becomes just an opium of the people to take in rather than a lie that needs to be called into question.
We should add to that Lynn Stewart, a political prisoner, dying of cancer in Texas, as we speak.
Absolutely, no brother.
Wow. What a week. Our Hot Stuff conversation continues 7 days a week on our website, smileyandwest.com, or call our Speak Out Network hotline anytime at 855-SPEAK-OUT. That's 855-SPEAK-OUT.
There's a mighty battle coming, and it's well now on its way. It'll be fought at Amu Garden. It shall be a sad, sad day. In the book of Revelation, words in chapter 16 say, there'll be gathered their great armies for that battle on that day. All the way from the gates of Eden to the battle of Amu Garden, there's been trouble and tribulation, there'll be sorrow and despair. He has said, ye not be troubled, for these things shall come to pass. Then your life will be eternal when you dwell with him at last.
Over the past 3 years, we've received letters from all sorts of listeners, including college students, ex-offenders, and military veterans. Well, this week we received an email through our website, smileyandwest.com, from someone who falls into all three of those categories. Derek Laster wrote us from East Orange, New Jersey, and I quote, Doc, I think you are on the wrong side of the minimum wage debate. As someone who has managed a small business in the past and a former infantry Marine, I know that a wage raise equates to higher prices. The most effective way to increase income is education, close quote. Derek listens to us on WNYC through his smartphone, I'm told. Derek, good to have you on Smiling West. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Say hello to Dr. West.
Hello, Dr. West. Nice to meet you.
Hi, dear brother. How you doing there, man?
Pretty good.
Let me go back to your note, Derek, because the part that struck me was, and I repeat, I know that a wage raise equates to higher prices. The most effective way to increase income is education. Why does it have to be either or as opposed to both and? Put another way, why can't we raise the minimum wage to a living wage and make education in America a priority? Why do we have to choose?
One of the main points that I'd like to bring out is anytime you increase wages across the board for non-skilled workers, without increasing their productivity, what you're actually doing is creating inflation. And that's something that small businesses can't handle. Because when you don't increase their productivity, what you're doing is you're moving the bottom line of a business that may not be able to afford to hire now new workers or increase their infrastructure or things like that.
The fallacy there, though, brother, is that you would not have a small business if you didn't have demand. And you can't have demand unless people have money in their pockets. And people have more money in their pockets when they have wages, not only that are fair, but enough wages to sustain the demand. So you can't look at this solely through the lens of a small businessman trying to keep his profits up by keeping labor low, but rather the workers and the business who must have demand. And you can't have demand with low wages because people don't have money in their pockets to sustain your business.
Okay, you are correct on that principle.
But look at it this way. Let's say that you and I, we're a small business. We got a small business together. And the equipment that we're using, the price increases. And we know we can't do anything about it. We just accept it. So then we look toward the workers and want to either keep their wages lower or not allow them an increase because we've already assumed that the equipment that we're getting, that price is going to be high no matter what. Why is it we put the value much more on the equipment as opposed to the value on the worker? It's because we live in a system in which we can get away by keeping the wages for the workers low, but we don't live in a system where we could fight the people who are providing the equipment and increasing the prices. That's partly what capitalism is. It forces us to highlight the weak and the vulnerable and to make them pay the price rather than those at the top paying a price.
When we're talking about the minimum wage, we're talking about a large percentage of workers that are unskilled or mid-skilled or low-skilled. And what we see, especially here in America, is that the trend is the better educated, the more skills you have as a person, then the more likelihood is that you'll make a higher wage.
Now, if the jobs aren't available. You got PhDs out there dealing with low wages because the jobs aren't available.
Well, if the jobs are available, number one, and number two, let's back up even prior to that, if you can afford an education where the escalating prices are keeping people out of classrooms to begin with. I think the bottom line here, Brother Derek, and I agree with everything Doc has said, but I think the bottom line here is that what Doc and I have called for in our work individually and collectively is to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. We have to back up, and we could have started this conversation with defining what a minimum wage job doesn't even allow you to do. So the problem with our country is there are too many people making a minimum wage when we ought to be talking about a living wage, number one. And number two, the main reason, the bottom line for raising the price of products that you want to pass that on to the consumer, to your point, when you have to raise the wages of your minimum wage workers. The reason for doing that is to keep the profits high for the owners of those small businesses and for corporations, for that matter. It's all about giving more profit to the shareholder, whether it's an individual shareholder or millions of shareholders. And all Doc and I are saying is simply this. If you're going to raise the price of products and pass it on to the consumer so you can afford to pay your workers what you want to pay them, you're doing that only because you don't want to cut into your profits. And so the question is, why can't you share the profits with the workers? Why does everything begin and end with the enrichment of the owner of the small business?
As an investor, if I'm Warren Buffett and I'm looking at investing in, for example, Joe Smucatella's corner grocery store.
Sure.
If I look at his business plan and I say, okay, I'm going to make a certain percentage return off of my investment in this company, then that's why I'm investing in that company. If you start taking away the main motivation for investors, then they're not going to invest in small businesses.
We'll leave it on that note. I think the bottom line is that we have to
wealth to even
share
invest.
The wealth. Yeah.
You got to talk about big money, big banks,
that's
big
right.
corporations.
But,
we'll read Richard Wolff and Paul Krugman and others in terms of the defense of the minimum wage. But we appreciate your reflections on this, brother.
We do indeed. Derek Laster listens to us on WNYC on his smartphone out in East Orange, New Jersey. Derek, thanks for taking us to task here on Smiling West. We appreciate your time, sir.
All right, thanks.
Stay strong now.
And if you want to take us to task, just send us a message through our website, smilingwest.com, or call our Speak Out Network hotline at 855-SPEAK-OUT. That's 855-SPEAK-OUT.
And the winner is?
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2013 is to be awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW.
This year's Nobel Peace Prize winner announced in Oslo, Norway, Friday morning. It was 37 years ago in 1976 when our next guest found out she had won the coveted prize. Mairead McGuire turned her own family's tragedy into the Community of Peace People, an integrated organization of Catholics and Protestants that sought a nonviolent solution to violence in occupied Ireland. She joins us today from the BBC studios in Belfast, where she's still fighting for peace and justice to this very day. Ms. McGuire, an honor to have you on Smiley and West. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you all.
Let me start by asking, Ms. McGuire, what was that family tragedy that I referenced a moment ago that put everything else in motion for you?
Well, in August 1976, in the height of a very violent ethnic conflict in Northern Ireland, there was a clash between an active service unit of the army and the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. And as a result of that, three of my sister's little children were all killed, and she herself dangerously ill. And at that stage, myself, Betty Williams, Kieran McCune, a young journalist, we all joined together, and our message was, let's stop the violence, let's try to solve our problems through dialogue, through non-violent ways, because enough is enough and too many people have died.
Where and how did your work start specifically?
Well, it specifically grew out of the death of the children and the fact that since 1969, in Northern Ireland, we had had violence from many, many sides, and that every day people were dying and that people didn't know where to turn in order to begin to solve the problem. So when the little children died, it just was the final straw, and people came out in thousands and thousands to respond to the call for a peaceful, non-violent solution to what is a very deep ethnic political conflict. That was the beginning of it. And in the first 6 months of the Peace People, there was a 70% decrease in the rate of violence, and people began to solve the problem within the communities, and that then encouraged the politicians eventually to get round the table and help solve what is a political ethnic conflict.
Mm-hmm. When you have such a noble and profound commitment to a non-killing culture and non-violent society, but yet we know the world that we live in is just shot through with so much hatred and killing and war. I mean, how do you sustain your hope?
Well, I sustain my hope because I believe that people are good. People essentially want to solve their problems through peace and through non-violence. And whenever I see this witness, be it I travel in Afghanistan, the Congo, just back from Syria, there you see people on the ground working non-violently and saying, we want to solve this in a peaceful way. And that's where I get my hope from. I also believe in the power of prayer, the power of solidarity with each other, and the absolute conviction that every human life is sacred and we can solve our problems without using violence.
Mm. You won the Peace Prize just 12 years after Dr. King. Dr. King was and still is the youngest person to ever win the Peace Prize. Say a word to me about Dr. King and his fight for nonviolence in this country and beyond.
Well, a great influence. Dr. King very clearly was for justice, for human rights, for equality, for racial rights and integration. But he saw the violence, but he always maintained that love, compassion, the values of respect for life, respect for each other, were very important, and that you should use the means of nonviolence to bring about real social and political change. So Martin Luther King had a great influence on my life, as did Dorothy Day, a wonderful woman in America. When I was a young teenager, I read about the work of Dorothy Day and her commitment to nonviolence and social justice. And also, of course, we have Gandhi. We have many prophets of nonviolence, but essentially In my own life, I come back to the message of Jesus, which is absolute nonviolence. Mm. You know, you cannot imagine Jesus with a machine gun. It just doesn't make sense.
Mm.
He's the greatest example of nonviolence for those of us who come from a Christian tradition.
Well, we're going to have a wonderful celebration for the great Dorothy Day, November the 8th in New York City. So I'll be raising your voice alongside others in terms of keeping track of her legacy. But what do you make of Jesus in the temple running out the money changers? That doesn't look as nonviolent as one would think, does it? That's pretty aggressive, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think that Jesus was totally nonviolent and loving, but he was also very human in that he got angry when he saw such injustice and the poor suffering. So I think that he would have most certainly challenged injustices in different ways. And indeed, that's why he was crucified, because he challenged the establishment and the injustice. But, you know, sometimes as time goes on, people portray people in their own image. And I don't see Jesus as striking anyone at all. He didn't use physical violence. He used the power of love. But the artists always take their own picture of it. So I really don't accept that Jesus would have used a whip on anyone. I believe that he would have challenged everyone and loved everyone and challenged them to be the very best they could be. And he loved the sinners, you know, it was the sin that he challenged. So yeah, I believe that if we as people can deepen our, no matter what religion or no religion or what religion, if we can deepen our compassion and our love for each other, we can challenge those who use violence to say there is another way.
Mm. There was no Peace Prize, no Nobel Peace Prize during the time of Jesus. And had there been, I could make a strong argument for political reasons why they wouldn't have given it to Jesus anyway. But they did not give the Peace Prize to Gandhi, whose name you raised early. He never won the prize. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's very sad that they didn't give the prize to Gandhi, because he most certainly deserved it. I just this week reread his little book, Truth is God and God is Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And Gandhi was the most wonderful example of living nonviolence and love and concern for the poor. And it's great pity he never received the prize. But perhaps it recalls us to look at who the prize is being given to and not given to. You know, we have to revisit Alfred Nobel's will. Alfred Nobel, quite clearly, over 100 years ago, had a vision, and he left his Peace Prize to those who would work for a world without armies, to those who would work for fraternity amongst the nations, to those who would have conferences and dialogue so that the problems could be solved in a humane way. And the Nobel Committee has a moral and legal responsibility to see that the prize is given to people and it falls within that criteria.
Mm.
For the Nobel Prize itself, it is actually, the committee is made up of people who are ex-parliamentarians from the Norwegian government. And I think that that committee should have on it at least people who know and understand the world of peacemaking, the world of non-killing, the world of reconciliation, and look for the voices who are visionaries, who are challenging us to move out of militarism and war. I mean, it is a tragedy that 100 years after we fought the war, that Europe is becoming more and more militarized. We have NATO now, we have something like 16 battle groups across Europe that come under no one's legal protection. And the militarization of Europe through NATO, we are going completely the wrong way. And Alfred Nobel wanted us to go in a different way. He wanted us through international law, through human rights, through upholding our international responsibilities, through the United Nations, not through NATO and Europe or America, but through the United Nations. He wanted us to solve our problems based on law. And tragically, law is being set aside by so many governments, and we're becoming highly militarized world, which is extremely dangerous. And we need to challenge this and turn it around if we are to give our children any hope for the future.
I know you were very critical even of Brother Barack Obama receiving the prize, though. Is that right?
I think that whenever Obama was elected, and I myself was delighted to see that, he was elected on the platform of change is possible and we can do it. And sadly, we have been very disappointed by that. You know, we have seen the American government continue its policies of perpetual war, continue its policies of bypassing human rights and international treaties, continue its policies of supporting governments like Israel in the Middle East, who is the most illegal government in the world next to America. So we have seen policies that are really creating a great deal of tragedy in the world and violence. Whenever 11th of September happened, it was tragic. We all remember where we were when that terrible bombing took place and feel the sadness for the families. But, you know, a wonderful thing would have been had America had taken the moral high ground and said, we can solve these problems through dialogue, through dealing with the root causes of the violence. But tragically, Americans' foreign policy became the war on terror. And we have seen the results of war on terror. It has made our world, particularly the Middle East, highly dangerous, because we've seen many people, young people, taking up guns, suicide bombings, killings, in revenge and retaliation because of their countries being invaded. Iraq. I was in Iraq before the war started. We knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan last December. The Afghani people are suffering so, so much. Libya, bombed by NATO and left trying to pick up the pieces. And I've come back from Syria, where what was going on there was a proxy war. This was a Western agenda to bring down a government. Thank God, we hope it's failed, because the American people had the good sense to mobilize against more wars, more occupations. I pay credit to the American peace movement for their courage in doing this.
We could debate, and I suspect we will in the time we have left. I would certainly love to get your thoughts on the American peace movement. I've got my critique of the American peace movement, which is in many ways almost non-existent these days. There are some still on the front lines, but it's not what it used to be. We'll come back to that perhaps later in this conversation. But you mentioned a couple of things that I want to follow up right quick. I know Dr. West wants to get back in here as well. Two things. Number one, I've talked to any number of world leaders, interviewed them over the years, certainly of late, and there are a lot of people who would say, one, it is difficult to take the moral high ground when so many rogue states and terrorist organizations are operating in the gutter. If they're operating in the gutter, how do you take the moral high ground? That's one question. And the second issue is Israel. Since you mentioned Israel specifically, not so long ago I interviewed the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and I asked him specifically in our conversation about why he wouldn't give peace a chance. I specifically framed the question around the notion of Kingian nonviolence. And what Mr. Netanyahu said to me was, with all due respect to Dr. King, who I have great regard for, Tavis, you and I disagree on this point because Dr. King did not know these rogue states. Dr. King didn't know these terrorist organizations. Dr. King didn't know Al-Qaeda. Dr. King didn't know Hezbollah. He went on to make the point that peace just is not the option that it used to be in the world that we live today. So that's my thought. Take it away.
Well, if we continue down the road of demonizing each other and arming our world with weapons, nuclear weapons, conventional weapons, then we will destroy each other. The best way in which to solve the problems is to begin dialogue, to talk to your opponents, to begin to deal with the root causes of what it's all about. Now, Israel, I've been many times to Israel and to Palestine. I'm currently three times deported for trying to bring food into the people of Gaza. We have to talk to each other. We have to reach out the hands of friendship. We have to begin to disarm our hearts, our minds, and our world. And we can only do this one-to-one, group-to-group, country-to-country. Now, in the Middle East, Israel needs to begin to make friends with the Arab world around it. Israel has nuclear weapons. Mordecai Vanunu, 26 years ago, told us Israel has nuclear weapons. He's sitting inside Jerusalem, forbidden to leave Jerusalem because he had the courage to tell us, one of our great whistleblowers in the world today. But Israel has nuclear weapons, it has chemical weapons, it's one of the best armies in the world. And what good is that going to do it if it doesn't have friends around it? If it can't make friends with the Arab world, if it can't make friends with the Iranian world, it needs to begin to make friends. There are all sorts of ways to solve the problem of the Palestinians and Israel. People know what to do. What is lacking is the will on behalf of the Israeli government to actually deal with the issues. And it won't do it unless America, which funds it to the point of millions, it won't do it unless America says to Israel, sit down round the table, sort this out, because the key to peace in the Middle East is Palestine getting its freedom and getting its human rights. And Palestinians deserve that. We all need to have our freedom and human rights. Israel can and should begin to solve the problem non-violently. And if Iran and Syria is being asked to give up its chemical weapons, Israel needs to give up its chemical weapons. If we're trying to build a world with no nuclear weapons, Israel needs to start the process in the Middle East of abolishing its nuclear weapons, because it started it in the first place. Iran is now reaching out to the world, and we need to take that reaching out and start dialogue. If the American president wants to make peace, remove the war on terror policy, respond to Iran, lift the sanctions against Syria and Iran and North Korea, where the people are starving. Lift the sanctions, sit down round the table and solve the problem in a proper, civilized way. It can be done. It's not impossible. All we need is the will to do it.
And where does that will come from? The kind of courage that you're talking about to really tell the truth, and therefore, I mean, what you say right now that constitutes a major threat to those who rule in the American empire and their connection wherever it is. It could be in Latin America, it could be in the Middle East, it could be in Africa, with AFRICOM, we're focusing on Israel at the moment. But the tentacles of the U.S. empire are such that your words and the actions that could follow therefrom require a level of courage that is rather rare in the world, don't the Sister McGuire?
Well, I think we have to let go of our fear. You know, we have fear and we have love in our own mindsets. Now, we can continue down with the fear and the militarization and the demonization and the hatred of other people, which is often fed by propaganda, a war propaganda. Or we can start to change our own mindsets. We can put on love instead. We can reach out to each other. We can recognize that the people of Israel are afraid and they are suffering. The people of Palestine are afraid and they are suffering. But that can be solved with a will. We can reach out to North Korea and know that people there are starving. And the problem of North Korea can be solved in Washington when the American government decides that instead of threatening North Korea with bombs and nuclear weapons, that it's going to solve the problem of North Korea. So these problems have all sorts of possibilities once we stop being afraid and look out as to how we can solve it together, which the people of the world want. Millions and millions of people marched before the Iraqi war started. I know, I was in India and marched with them. I was in New York and marched with them. People of the world want peace. We've had enough of war and killing, and we don't want nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. People are hungry. We need to put the money into education, into healthcare, into job creation, into building friendships across the world. And America is needed to do that. We need America to do that.
I want to go back to Iran here in just a second, Ms. McGuire. Before I do that, Doc, I wonder, because I don't want to get too far afield here and forget this. Ms. McGuire, Doc, earlier in this conversation offered her own assessment thanking the American peace movement. I take what she meant by that. But I wonder, Doc, if I'm just curious to get your take on what you make of the American peace movement at the moment before we advance on to some other stuff. I don't want to lose sight of that.
Well, I mean, I salute, Code Pink and Sister Medea Benjamin and the others. There's a whole slew of peace activists. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it was really the Parliament in London that had the major impact on the short-sighted elites in Washington and the White House and Congress. That was a major factor that impeded the march toward a war of aggression, mm-hmm. or at least dropping bombs on the precious people in Syria. Now, we know the war crimes already committed in Syria by both sides, but to add more war crimes, I think, would have been just a morally obscene. But I do think that the peace movement is there, but it's just not as strong as we would like. We're going to have the wonderful drone conference in just a few weeks there, bringing together peace activists.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, Ms. McGuire, your salute to the peace movement is very important in terms of the efficacy of the peace movement. We all would like to see it much more effective, I think.
Ms. McGuire, to the point that Dr. West raises now, before we advance, your take right quick on that all-important vote heard around the world by the Parliament in London when the Prime Minister Cameron was asking for something that he did not get. It changed all kind of politics there and certainly here in the United States.
Yes, it was a wonderful vote, and congratulations to the UK Parliament for voting against a military or a strike. But that came from the grassroots. That came from people in the constituencies, mm-hmm. saying to the members of Parliament, we don't want any more war, we've had enough, and we don't want any more. So people have power. People have the power to pick up the phone, say to their elected representatives, this is what I want. And people around the world are saying no to war.
Mm-hmm.
And can I just come back to the fact that in Syria, when I visited Syria in May, what we discovered on the ground in Syria was a proxy war that was going on. There were thousands and thousands of foreign jihadists paid for by outside governments and trained, who were trying to bring down the Assad government. And they were murdering and killing in the most extreme forms. And this has happened in other countries where outside intervention has brought down governments. And we need now to say that this kind of outside proxy wars are not acceptable in our world mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm.
Syria can be solved through dialogue, through reconciliation, and hopefully will be an example where people mobilized to say to no side, no outside intervention and the bringing down of their elected government.
To your point, John Kerry, our Secretary of State, just the other day praised Syria for its cooperation on the chemical weapons. We will see what happens in the coming days, but your point is very well taken. Before our time runs out, I want to go back to Iran, because that is, alongside Syria, one of the major issues vis-a-vis our foreign policy of the day. As you well know, Ms. McGuire, President Obama spoke to Mr. Rouhani the other day by phone, first time since 1979 that the head of our country and the leader of Iran have had any kind of dialogue or exchange whatsoever. And I come back to Iran because while the President Obama and Mr. Rouhani did in fact talk, and the world is getting one image of where Iran wants to go, given the speech that Mr. Rouhani gave at the United Nations, we now hear Mr. Netanyahu, at his recent speech at the UN, come out and tell the world not to trust Mr. Rouhani, not to trust Iran. It was fire and brimstone when Bibi Netanyahu got a chance to give his speech at the lectern at the UN. What do you make of his telling us that this guy is not to be trusted, that Iran is not to be trusted, and that the U.S. basically is getting suckered at the moment?
I think we need to start trusting each other. And I believe that we need to start to trust Iran. Now, in saying that, Iran has a long way to go. It has to uphold its human rights, its international laws. It has to uphold its rights for women. I have some friends who have been imprisoned inside Iran purely for calling for rights for women in Iran. So Iran is not perfect, but there is no country in the world that is perfect. But Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. It has asked to be able to have energy, to be able to do that itself. Iran has a right to have its own uranium processing, as so many other countries have. But I think it's important to sit down with Iran to lift the sanctions against Iran and to lift sanctions also against Syria and North Korea. Sanctions usually only affect the people on the ground, particularly the little children, as happened in Iraq, and to solve the problem, because the Middle East needs peace. And Iran is part of that, as is Israel and Palestine and Syria. Let's try a different way other than militarism and war. Let's try the way of peace and upholding international laws and human rights.
If President Obama were here, or Secretary of State Kerry were in this conversation, how would you respond to them saying to you, Ms. McGuire, I hear your point about war, and even if we take your point about war and peace, economic sanctions is preferred to dropping bombs, preferred to dropping drones. And economic sanctions oftentimes are the pressure that we apply to get countries to do better by those same persons that you and I are both concerned about. How would you respond to their pushing back on you and the notion of lifting all economic sanctions even?
Well, when we were in Iraq, 1.5 million children under the age of 5, this is before the war now, had died because of sanctions put on against the Iraqi people. One young Iraqi girl said to me, this is like a nuclear bomb. We are losing all our people through economic sanctions. So I would appeal that the sanctions be lifted and that dialogue be given and negotiation be given a chance. And the world has had enough of war and militarism. We really have to begin to solve our problems through dialogue, negotiation, and through non-killing and non-violence. It's the future of the world, and I hope that the leaders will begin to respond to the cry of the people for give peace a chance.
Mairead McGuire won the Nobel Peace Prize along with Betty Williams back in 1976, 12 years after Dr. King, for her work with the Community of Peace People. She joined us from the BBC studios in Belfast. Ms. McGuire, an honor to have you on this program. Thanks for sharing your insights today.
Thank you very much indeed, and love to you all.
Take care. What a calm spirit and courageous person you are.
Catch me weeknights on my TV show on PBS.
You can catch me this Wednesday, October 16th, at University of North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina, or Thursday, October 17th, at Southern Oregon University in Asheville.
You can join the conversation 7 days a week on our website, smileyandwest.com, or call our Speak Out Network hotline at 855-SPEAK-OUT.
Smiley and West is produced by SRP Productions and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. The views expressed on this program are very much our own and do not necessarily represent the views of PRI or this station.
Our producers, Joe Zephyrin, our Jay-Z, our engineer, the legendary Johnny Morris. This program mixed and recorded in the Cheryl Flowers Radio Studios here in Los Angeles.
In West Windsor, New Jersey, I'm Cornell West. Stay strong, my brothers and sisters of all colors.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.